Yo, what's cracking? This your homeboy Ice Cube, and you tuned in to Everything Snowboarding and More podcast. You know what it is, baby.
Hey, everybody, this is Mike. Welcome back to episode number 53 of the Everything Snowboarding, Outdoors, and More podcast. This week's podcast is being sponsored by Alec Punks. Alec Punks offers snowboard, helmet, headphones that are basically wireless audio communication. You can use these for mountain biking, motorcycle riding, just trying to figure out where your kids are at, all sorts of fun stuff. So for more information on Alec Punks, they're available for pre-order at alec.io. This week's special guest is Jeremy Jones. Jeremy Jones is a legendary big mountain snowboarder. He is the founder of Jones Snowboards, Techstar winners. This is the second time I've had Jeremy on the podcast. Super honored to have Jeremy back. And we talked about a lot of stuff. We covered everything from snowboarding to diet, avalanche education. This is a really fun podcast. So make sure you have the time. It's about 40 minutes long to sit down and listen to this entire audio with Jeremy Jones. Jeremy, thanks for coming on the show. And tell us a little bit about this book. Like, what was the background of you, you know, taking time out from your busy day, everything you're doing, to write a book about being in the mountains?
I guess why I wrote the book is because I feel like I have, you know, had learned a lot of lessons in the mountains, some of those really tough, and lessons that almost killed me. So it's, you know, my hope is that maybe people reading the book won't have to learn quite so hard of lessons. And then I would just add, I also felt there's some incredible avalanche safety books and things of that written from guides. And I wanted to kind of give the perspective of a Schralpinist, meaning someone that, yes, I absolutely use formal avalanche tactics and techniques and stuff, but I'm really coming at it from a person that wants to go ride the best lines in the best conditions and do it safely.
And, you know, I love that you kicked off the book and you said, you know, hey, this isn't, you know, a true avalanche book, you know, go out and get your education. But like one of the things, and I think you and I talked about this last time, you know, when Jones Snowboards, when you're sending me boards or split boards, you've got, you know, your five red flags. And so, you know, even though you're not, you know, necessarily an avalanche educator, it's great to see that you're kind of sharing this stuff from somebody that actually goes out and participates, you know, with your background.
Yeah, I think it's a lot to ask someone to say, be a level three, you know, mountain guide that has spent thousands of dollars and months of their life on formal education. And I would say I personally have built a protocol that I use that just stacks the deck in my favor. So, for example, the five red flags, it's on the sleeves of our jackets, it's on our snowboards, and it's just something, you know, to have those five red flags just in front of your face on a daily basis, that will greatly reduce your odds of getting caught and killed in an avalanche. Now, that doesn't mean you can just walk blindly into the mountains, but you can, you know, a lot of the stuff that my approach is built on is just stacking the deck in your favor. So, and trying to simplify this stuff, because the avalanche and studying snowpacks and crystals and snow pits and stuff, it's a lot. And so I guess just to dive into a snow pit, for example, because in an avalanche course, a two-day avalanche course, you know, 40% of that's about how nice your snow pit is. Now, to get to a level with snow pits where you can dig a snow pit and say, I am going to stake my life on the results of this snow pit and my observation and of whether or not this slope is going to slide, I mean, that is a really complicated thing. And you know, of course, that's not, that's just one data point, but I think it's a data point that, you know, maybe you spent too much time on in an early avalanche course.
That makes total sense. You know, you also talk about Craig in your book, The Art of Schralpinism, and it was kind of interesting how you mentioned kind of not making the cut for the Olympics, and then all of a sudden you find yourself out free riding with Craig. And like this, free riding wasn't really a thing then. Now you're kind of the face of free riding. And if we look back at Snow Science, you know, at that time, Craig Kelly was probably the snowboarder that had the most education of any splitboarder out there. I mean, I think there's maybe a couple guys up in Canada that, you know, Joey and a few of those other guys, but really, I mean, Craig was like the top of the top, and he still ended up dying in an avalanche. And so even if you know everything and you're doing the pits, I mean, you're still out there playing. There's a variable that we just as humans can't fully ever control.
Yeah, and that's the sad truth about the mountains is experts and heroes of mine, mentors of mine, you know, so many of them have died in avalanches. And avalanches, they don't care how many courses you've taken or if you've been on cover of magazines and movies. And the sad reality is, the consequences are real. And in our society, it's so common for almost risks to get blown out of proportion. But when it comes to the backcountry, man, we cannot overstate the severity of the dangers out there and the fact that one bad call can erase a lifetime of good calls.
For sure. And how do you manage, you know, business and pleasure? Say you're out in the backcountry and you're doing something for Jones Snowboards and, you know, you're with a bunch of friends and you've got a good crew, you've got all your Jones athletes out there, and then you also have a film crew out there. Does it get hard, you know, if there's the pressure of trying to get the shot or the social media aspect? I know a lot of our listeners, you know, they're Instagrammers, they're people that are trying to get content, and it seems like people push a little bit farther and a little bit farther. And then with what you do, you know, you are the face of Jones Snowboards. So is it sometimes hard just to kind of balance that business pleasure? And then at the same time, do you ever have to back off, or have you had to back off the whole group saying, you know what, I know we're out here filming and I know we need to get the content, but hey, something's not right. Let's come back and do it again tomorrow.
Well, I've been making movies in the mountains a lot with my brothers and Hatchet Brothers. Going over 25 years now. And so that's a lesson you are forced to learn, often the hard way. Hopefully it doesn't kill you or you don't get seriously hurt, but you learn that pretty quick of, look, don't get caught up in the moment. Don't get caught up. This is the last day of the trip. Don't get caught up in it's sunny and you ride this line and you're going to be a hero. Those are hard lessons to learn, but I've done it enough. And so the other thing, it's about the crew. I've worked with a lot of different film crews, and there's a reason why so much of my work was with the Hatchet Brothers and my brothers, because, you know, we knew it was our atmosphere out there was always, for example, if I called over the radio and said, man, I don't know, I'm not feeling it. And this could be a minute before we're getting ready to drop in. And we put weeks into this line. And if that radio call on the other side is not good call, dude, totally get it. Let's bail. And, you know, we'll reevaluate another time, you know, maybe tomorrow's the day. So that's a super critical aspect to it. And then when it comes to backing off the lines, or I guess another really good way to kind of get there is how you frame going into the mountains and the language you use. We never say we're gonna go ride the Widowmaker today. It's always, man, we've been building up to this thing, and maybe today is the Widowmaker gonna be in. And so when it comes to climbing a line, we are all on the same page of, we need to turn 20 no's into 20 yeses. And if we win the lottery today, it's almost out of surprise where you're like, holy shit, I can't believe we just had 20 green lights and we're on top of this thing. So it's always having half a foot, you know, out the door and ready to turn around. And then it goes into, when was the last time you've turned around? I keep track of that. You have to practice that. So maybe things are getting a little weird and it's like, you know what, we haven't turned around in 2 weeks, we're out of here. And so just having everyone's intentions before the day even starts, everything's a maybe today is absolutely critical.
Oh, that's great. And it seems like it's more about the actual experience. Like you guys are going out there, maybe you get the shot, but it's not like the pressure, like we have to ski this line today. And I think a lot of times people, I mean, I see it here in the Tetons. I'm going to ski XYZ line next Saturday because that's the day I have off. And it's like, well, what happens if the conditions aren't there? Like that's something you mean the night before you might have green light, you get out in the field and all of a sudden you're like, I'm not feeling it. And so it's great that you were able to have that communication, you know, with the Hatchet brothers and then especially with your own family, with Todd and Steve. Let's switch over. I was going to ask you about Kai. Recently, Kai's your nephew. Recently, Kai got injured skiing. What's that looking like for Kai and what kind of recovery do you see him as a young athlete, especially with the support of Red Bull and, you know, TGR moving forward?
Well, you know, really unfortunate situation with Kai. I mean, he hit an air, you know, of magnitude and size that he's, you know, I've seen him hit four of those in a day in December. I mean, you know, so very much in his, not this crazy daredevil type stuff, in his wheelhouse. And it just coincided with that age. I have another friend who's Kai's age who had a growth plate issue, you know, similar injury to Kai's and stuff I'd never heard of. So unfortunate event for how severe the injury is and the fact that he was bedridden for so long. But Kai, we stayed close to it, especially at the beginning. And I told him the same thing I tell everyone is, you know, there's really two things. One, it's your turn, meaning we all get injured. And two, never waste an injury. And Kai wrote that on his kind of rehab board and just dove headfirst into rehab. And without doubt, I mean, he's just been all in on this injury. He's had a very inspiring attitude towards it. There were certainly tough days. I mean, he couldn't even roll on his side in his hospital bed for a couple weeks. And so it's been incredibly hard, but he is walking and he's actually, there's some incredible healers in the Tetons. This guy, Jeff Archibald, who I actually grew up competing against, has been instrumental, and he's kind of built his healing ecosystem, which is critical. And without doubt, this has been a life-changing event for him and in a really positive and inspiring manner.
Yeah, it's great to see the progression that he's making. And, you know, one of the things I reached out to him again, and I said, same like you did. Hey, it was just a matter of time. Like now it's like this is where the real stuff happens. It's not a matter of like what happens to you. It's that how you recover through this. And then all of a sudden I ended up breaking my fibula toward the end of the ski season. And I see Kai in Medicine Wheel and all of a sudden he's in the anti-gravity treadmill. And I'm like, this guy, I just heard he was being helied out of the backcountry, and his progression now, you know, working with Jeff and working with Francine Bartlett and the whole Medicine Wheel team, it's just been so inspiring. And it's one of the things that I tell athletes, and you know this just like anybody else. I mean, I might be able to start running again here in the next couple of weeks. And so just that time of like getting back to yoga and starting Pilates again, and then I had all this time to kind of just slow down and look at my diet. And, you know, I definitely want to talk to you about food, because how do you think food plays into injury reduction and as well as recovery for athletes?
Yeah, I mean, I think food long-term is really important. I mean, I was on the pro tour and we were living out of cars and subsiding on 99-cent Whoppers and, you know, just eating like shit. And it seems like kind of you do that for a little while, but over time that stuff really catches up to you. And I have slowly trended to a plant-based diet. And I, you know, it's one of those things, I hesitate to go deep into the diet world, but I think, you know, eat with intention, think about how it's making your body feel. I think I dealt with a bad back starting at 23 years old. So I realized right away of, you know, if I have 10 extra pounds of excess weight, that's like directly to my back. So the kind of pretty quickly I went and was like, what's my fighting weight, just to reduce the impact on my back. And so I think that that is one thing over time where there's a trend where people get older and they get heavier. And then as their joints are getting older, and then now they're carrying more weight on those joints, I think that, you know, that's something to really keep an eye on. And I've always felt like I'm too lazy to get out of shape or get overweight. I don't want to have to go on a diet. I don't want to have to, you know, all try to get back into shape. So I've just, for, you know, since my 20s have just been, and I'm allergic to gyms. So I try to get my fitness through fun activities, and I will go, oh, you know, whatever, pickleball is really good for cutting on a hard surface. So instead of having to go and do plyometrics, it's like I'm out playing pickleball or hiking with rocks or what have you. But yeah, I just think it's, and then we, as we've said, we all get injured and then really deep dive into those injuries and not brushing them aside. Because for me, it's about the long game. I love nothing more than being in the mountains, snowboarding or surfing or biking, just this active lifestyle. And so I've just really prioritized that. But also by playing the long game, I'm not a fitness freak. So it's a more long-term sustainable, because we sometimes you see these athletes that have been whatever, going for X Games gold and having to be at such a high level, and then they retire, and understandably, they're like, man, I never need to count a calorie again, or what, you know, I mean, not that I'm definitely not a calorie counter, but, you know, it's like, what's the stuff you can implement into your life that you can consistently do every day? And for me, that's just little things, because I'm not super disciplined, like I'm going to wake up at 5 and run 5 miles every day.
You know, I was really surprised to hear and read that you had been on a plant-based diet, and then especially to hear you say it's been this long. Last year in January, I ended up switching over to a vegetarian diet, and I did that all the way up until hunting season. And then I had elk hunting tags, and I thought, well, I don't know if I really want to be out elk hunting this year if I'm still on a vegetarian diet. So I switched over. But while I was on a vegetarian vegan diet, I had more energy, and I was surprised because all of a sudden when I switched to a plant-based diet, I wasn't bonking anymore. I would be out splitboarding, I'd be out touring, and I wasn't crashing. I was like just eating my nuts and I was eating my snacks and I was eating as I went, but I wasn't having the same spikes that I did. And then I started researching and I was like, wow, there's actually a lot of athletes that are on a plant-based diet or that maybe switch over to it. And for me, I mean, it really worked. I'm not on it at the moment. And fortunately, we had a vegan restaurant opened in Jackson called Sulano Cafe, and it was incredible. And I was literally there twice a day. I mean, I was still trying to learn to figure out how to cook for myself and, you know, vegetarian food. But I was able to go to this place, and somehow, I mean, it didn't work in Jackson. And so I laugh. I'm like, we're in this community with all these active people and all these people that want to be outdoors and care about their health. And here was this vegan restaurant where they were cooking everything from scratch every single day. And it went out of business. And people would look at me and they'd be like, how can you even have enough energy being on a plant-based diet? Could you talk to that? I mean, are there people that kind of look at you and think, gosh, like, don't you eat steak all the time and potato? Like, don't you need that to be the guy that can human power himself up mountains?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like that has been that's kind of a 10-year-old conversation, but maybe in Wyoming, it's not. But one thing I would just say is what bothers me is titles to diets. And, you know, I don't want to go deep into this, but another simple way is, you know, understanding the footprint of your food, and eating elk that you killed is a very low carbon way to get your protein. So I commend anyone who does that, and a lot of respect for that. But yeah, I think that, you know, so I would just say to listeners, like, eat more vegetables. It's really hard to get overweight eating vegetables. And then from a personal perspective, I just feel like it's made me more spry, is the simplest way. It was kind of, I naturally dropped a little bit of weight, and then which inevitably, I mean, go look at ultra runners or anyone that's really doing, you know, going far and long, and they're generally not a ton of body fat on them. So yeah, and then just being aware of what when you eat, how does it make you feel? Like, I mean, you go, and again, I've eaten plenty of meat in my life, and I remember how I kind of was eye-opening for me was, it was Sherry McConkie who did this Meatless Mondays. And so I'm like, I'll check that out. And I remember going out to this one restaurant that it wasn't that I was eating a lot of red meat, but that place had the best steaks. And I'm like, I guess I'm going to try this veggie dish. And I remember having the veggie dish and then getting out of dinner and going, wow, I don't have what would normally be this brutal food coma that would be kind of a restless night of sleep. And it's just an example of if I had really thought about, like, how, if your food after you eat it is, like, you know, making you lie down on the couch, it's probably not the best thing.
Awesome. All right, Jeremy. So we covered the part about, you know, if you're going full-blown diet, but for somebody that's just looking for, you know, some added protein or from snacks in the field, like what are some of the ways that you can get that, again, without having to, you know, maybe just change your entire diet?
Yeah. Protein is definitely kind of the crux of a plant-based diet. And especially as someone who loves to ride day after day, for sometimes weeks on end, the key is to get immediate protein right after you've done your exercise. And for me, that means it's tricky because so often the trailhead's an hour from my house or town or what have you. And that's why I always have pistachios in my car. They give you two things that I always crave in the mountain, which is salt and then the ability to recover. And they, you know, are super high in protein, similar amounts of potassium as a banana, and, you know, antioxidants of blueberries. So it's kind of the perfect food, and why if you were to, you know, drive to the mountain in my car, you'd see pistachio shells all over the floor. And I never leave home without them.
And it's not necessarily just something that, you know, mountain athletes are using. I mean, my mom used to love pistachios for, you know, heart health and brain health. And so that was the first person that I had ever really seen kind of doing that. And I was like, huh. And then as I started researching it, you know, it talks about how it controls blood sugar and then all the different antioxidants. I eat a lot more almonds, but as I've looked at, you know, how I can be less impactful, I think pistachios are a little bit less water consumption as far as being made. And how are you connected with the American Pistachios Growers?
So I got connected with them a while ago at an event. It was a media event, and there was a bunch of different booths, and I immediately went and shook them down for pistachios because, it's my favorite nut. And then one thing led to another, and I've been working with them for close to maybe a decade now.
And you mentioned that you have pistachio shells in your truck or in your vehicle. So do you prefer the actual shelled pistachios versus just like a bag of just ready to go ones?
I mean, they're both fine, but there is something about just the process of deshelling them. And I'm not picky, but yeah, they are in my mind. I'm not also crazy about taking vitamins or pills or anything. So I do think of them as a daily vitamin just because of how nutritious they are.
Totally. Okay. So we've talked about your diet. You're not in the gym. You're out playing pickleball, you're splitboarding. what are some of the other ways that you're...
I love the pickleball. I say pickleball because cutting, that's the one thing is us, because I mountain bike a shit ton. I surf, I hike, I do all these things. But the hardest one to get is that lateral explosive cutting. So I've always, you know, thought about though, whether it was soccer or whatever, you know, getting that lateral cutting through sport opposed to having to do plyometrics in a gym.
And then what about a stretch or a yoga routine? Do you bring a yoga mat with you, or in the morning, do you wake up and every day make sure you stretch out, or is it kind of on a as needed basis?
Great question. I have a really simple morning routine, again, out of laziness, because if it was too hard, then I'd talk myself out of it. And so that consists of rolling out on a foam roller, some planks, some bridges, some basic stretches, but it's really anywhere from 3 minutes to 5 minutes long. And so I think about this stuff as compounding returns. And we've heard Warren Buffett's version of that. But in life, you can have the same thing where 3 minutes a day means nothing. Meaning you do that once, you're like, whatever. You do that for a year, 5 years, 10 years. And all of a sudden, those 3 minutes a day have a massive impact on how you are, you know, a decade later. And then it's the same with the mind. Like I read every night, and it's rare for me to read more than 10 pages. But if you look at my bedside nightstand, because I do it every night, I read a lot of books every year. And again, 10 pages once doesn't do anything, but consistently doing that, it's the same with why I write. I probably write 4 days a week, and same with art. And it's all just stuff to open my mind, as my dad would say, get on the other side of your brain and let it take you for a ride. It's about the process. And so when you go into art with that, like with this book, I never wanted my art in it. And I never in a million years thought I would have art in this book. And I got talked into it, and we used it kind of in the margins to add some color, and I was at peace with it. But I've never, we put art on boards all the time, and they're like, why don't you put your art on? It's like, I'm not trying to be an artist. I just do it for the process.
Oh, I love it. I kind of touched on it earlier, but so tell us, let's backtrack to when you were trying to get into the Olympics, and all of a sudden, Jeremy Jones, the guy that we know as, the number one free rider, one of the fastest snowboarders in the world, you didn't make the cut for racing to get into the Olympics. And then you ended up getting to go free ride with Craig. How did that shape who you are? Because there was a quote in there that you said something about Craig wanted you guys to all, you went up early one morning and you just watched the sunrise and you didn't say anything. And I'm thinking, this sounds like the kind of stuff that you're doing with people now.
Well, that makes me happy to, I've never thought that, but I do definitely get people up early in the morning and watching sunrises. And I like to say, words never spoken, I wish I slept in, as someone watches a sunrise from a mountaintop. By the time I was, and I think probably why I didn't, or a factor of why I didn't make the Olympics is because my heart, as much as I tried to be there, I really, I was actually ready to stop racing. And then it got announced in the Olympics, and I was 21 at the time, and my parents were psyched and sponsors were psyched. They're like, you're going to go to the Olympics. And so I tried to, I worked really hard and I was driven towards it, but I just remember, we'd be on the mountain early, and it's common to wake up at 6 a.m. because we'd kind of train at certain mountains that would get on the mountains before they opened. And no matter what time I went to bed, it was impossible to get out of bed. And then as soon as the Olympics were over, I was living in Jackson, and I never needed an alarm. It was like 5:30 up, first tram every day. And it really showed me the power of how much more effective you are when you're really passionate about something. And I worked my ass off to try to go to the Olympics, but it just, it became kind of a job. And I've been asked a lot about, you must have been so bummed when you didn't go to the Olympics. And it was further from the truth. I was so happy because the last Olympic qualifier, my cousin Adam Hostetter and I, who grew up riding together, were both in a position for the last Olympic spot. And I got fourth, he got third, he got to go to the Olympics. I went to Canada with Craig and Johan, and then Johan Olsen and Alaska and all that stuff. And it, there are 2 days in my life that were the most exciting kind of freedom days. And that was graduating high school and my last snowboard race. And, you know, with both of those, I'm like, I can finally do what I want.
What would you say to people that have mixed snowboarding or surfing or sport with business and then started to kind of maybe feel not as passionate toward said sport? Have you seen that in the snowboard industry? I mean, obviously you kind of talked about it a little bit with racing, but like now, you know, you're the face of Jones Snowboards, and obviously you love getting out there and snowboarding, but it's, sometimes do you see it being difficult for people when their passion becomes their business as well? And how can people kind of maybe navigate through those waters?
Yeah, I've absolutely seen that. And I think of, because I've been doing it for so long, the amount of, say, generations of pros that I've had as riding partners that have moved on with their, you know, they kind of, unfortunately, it's a common path as you start getting injuries and you can't keep up and then you start getting paid. And then, I mean, I would say 70% of those pros that I rode with don't snowboard anymore. And it's, you know, somewhat understanding because it becomes such a grind. And then the other thing, I mean, if your whole life is, man, I love riding the park, I mean, that is going to end at some point. And I think the beauty of splitboarding is, one, it's really good on your body. I mean, there was a point where I thought I was going to have to retire due to back injuries, and it was really splitboarding that got me back. And it's exciting because there are a couple things with that. One is with splitboarding, it's endless, the opportunities to progress. You can always move through the mountains more efficiently, read the snow better, time it better, find the perfect line in the perfect conditions. And I still get in spots in the mountains a couple times a year where I go, I could not have been here a moment earlier in my life because I was lacking the experience. So that means that I am progressing. And that's it's this weird little, it's like the one area that I can definitively say that I'm progressing. But and then ironically, the other areas, I got two kids that are shredders and they ride the mountain all the time. And because I went and splitboarded and I couldn't ride hard pack anymore for a while because of my body, I'm actually back to charging bumpy hard pack steeps to a point where I can now keep up with these certain skiers that, you know, the hard charging skiers ripping down whatever it is, you know, the Alta chutes, and when it hasn't snowed in 3 weeks. And that ship had sailed a long time ago. And I'm like, holy shit, I've got my hard pack game is totally back. And I think that, you know, excessive walking uphill got me there.
I love it. And you've kind of opened up the mountains to a lot of people. And I think there's a lot of, you know, snowboarders that maybe were riding resorts for a long time and maybe kind of got burnt out with that. I mean, I was definitely, that's one of the reasons I asked that question. I was like, I'm not feeling this anymore. And then all of a sudden the splitboarding was like, ooh, this is so much different. And then all of a sudden I've been splitboarding for a bunch. And then I went and rode Jackson Hole probably 10 days this last winter. And I was like, oh my gosh, I forgot how much fun like lift access terrain is. Like I can go out to Four Pines. I'm like, this is just easy, and get into, you know, Alta chutes and everything. Like this is so much fun. And so it's great to be able to mix it up. And I'm sure that to hear you say 70% of your riding partners just, or, you know, athletes just don't even snowboard anymore. It kind of makes sense. And it's one of those things that I try and balance. I watched this with surfing. You know, I grew up surfing. A lot of my friends became pro surfers at, you know, 17, 18, moved to Indonesia. By the time they're 25, you know, they're overweight and they don't surf anymore. And it's like, what happened? And so sometimes it's, I think that balance, you know, my mom always said, you know, find something you love, make it your job. I think to an extent, you know, as long as you can kind of, you know, just make sure you still have that balance. Speaking of balance.
And sorry, just to add to that, I think creativity is super important on that, where, And then you nailed it on the head where you tore a ton, and then the thought of getting on a lift looks really good. You ride the lifts a bunch and you're like, oh, get me away from people. And then also that's where, you know, maybe it's equipment change, maybe it's pow surfing, but creativity is the key. And if you're getting bored with, there's so many different facets to the sport, and it's just go towards that.
Totally. And I like that you mentioned the creativity, because, you know, with Jones Snowboards, you've got your line of traditional, you know, solid boards, you've got your split boards, you've got pow surfers. I mean, you guys are kind of, you're doing a little bit of everything now. I used some of your outerwear last year. I liked some of the stretchy Gore-Tex. I was like, ooh, this is rad stuff. Tell us some of the cool things that are in the works right now for Jones Snowboards. I just saw an Instagram post that you had a board. I don't even know what model it was. And it kind of had a pointed nose, kind of reminded me of the slash shapes. And I like that. I mean, obviously you're out there, you did the whole line with the Surf Shaper, and you guys, you know, you were the Mind Expander. I mean, you've come out with some shapes that are fun. They're creative. It just seems like it's a different way of exploring the mountains. And can you tell us about some of the new stuff that's coming down the pipeline for Jones for next year?
Yeah. So it's just that change your board, change your mountain mentality. There's also with the high Avi Danger, for example, we have, speaking of this Chris Christensen Storm Chaser board, you're talking about it's a surf rocker of Christensen's fastest gliding surfboard, and we built it into this snowboard. And I bring that up because that board makes 20 to 30 degree pow so much damn fun. And what that allows, and same with the pow surfers the same way, if you don't have a board that makes 20 to 30 degree pow fun, then that's dangerous, quite frankly. And these boards, you know, they're not getting a lot of abuse. So literally my Storm Chaser is 8 years old. And so, yeah, that is a thing. And then as far as moving next year, what we got going on, we have some exciting new stuff. And I would say with board development, it's very much like that approach in the mountains, where what we're doing now with boards, I couldn't have imagined being there 3 years ago. And I think with board development, what I have found is you kind of get these progression bumps, and rocker would be an example that came along, whatever, 10, 12 years ago. And it first comes out and you're like, well, there's a whole new feeling going on here. And then you refine that feeling, and you start figuring out how to work with rocker the right way. And you get a bunch of progression, and then you're fine tuning that progression. And what we have going on right now is we're learning how to work with camber in a manner where you get the benefits and the edge hold and the snap of camber without the downside, which was a real sticky nose and tail that you had to fight to keep above crust or whatever, catching on a sharp transition or a mogul or what have you. And so that's been a really exciting place, and having these 3D spoon mixed in there with it is kind of taking the bite off of those really forward contact points. So yeah, the board, we have three new boards coming out next year, three new models, which is the Free Carver, which is a mix between a race board and a free ride board. That's the board I've ridden more than anything this year. It's one of those scenarios where if you told me that 3 years ago, I'd be like, you're crazy. I'm not riding a board like that. We got the Butterfly, which is this really compressed shape, but again, a long contact point. So I'm riding a 154 that rides every bit like my 161 would in that size. And then we have this new hovercraft, which has been a staple in the line from the beginning. And that's a whole new shape. And we got channels in the bottom and all this stuff. But what's really excited about that board, because at Jones, you know, we look at innovation on, yes, there's, you know, performance, but also we want to evolve with durability and sustainability. And this board, the hovercraft, this new hovercraft 2.0, we are taking old snowboards and have figured out a way to implement and get those back into this new board with this new construction. And that's in this new hovercraft. So upcycled snowboards, which is a dream.
Oh, I love that. And is that something that people will be able to send their old snowboards back to Jones to be a part of the program, or just something that you guys are just kind of using stock of, you know, demos and other material and boards that were laying around?
Yeah, absolutely. We will be collecting, and we have been collecting, old snowboards. The beauty of the process is it doesn't need to be just Jones boards. And then the ultimate, we think we could turn old skis into new snowboards, which would be ironic and fun.
I love that. It's something that the industry doesn't talk about as much. You know, I think every pair of skis or snowboard that was ever built is still in existence. You know, you can't throw a pair of skis or a snowboard in a landfill and expect that Mother Nature is just going to somehow disintegrate that board. I mean, there's just too much stuff in there. I mean, all the material and everything. So the fact that you guys are doing that, and I know over the years you've worked on your manufacturing and you've been very conscious about, you know, where the boards are being made and, you know, where the boards, you know, the shipping and where the materials are from. And even being upfront saying, you know, hey, like we try and do this as much as green as possible, and we want to be as environmentally friendly as we can. But like at the end of the day, we still are manufacturing something, and we're manufacturing snowboards. And so to hear this kind of green component or the upcycled, that's something that it seems like Jones is one of the innovators right now in the industry. I got just a couple more questions. So say you decided to design a board today, you go out, you're riding with people and you've got these ideas and you start sketching it up. How long until you can get an actual board back from one of the Jones factories that you can put onto snow? You know, obviously we're not as quick as like was the Surf Shaper, where they can just get out there and, you know, but like, what's the kind of the timeline for when you're having new ideas or shapes? Does it take, you know, 6 months, a year? What kind of window is that?
Well, I mean, the whole start to finish of new board to, or, you know, idea to new board is, I'm always tinkering on these things, and it can, some take many years and some go nowhere. And so we're really cognizant of, is there a spot in the line for this board? Is it bringing a new feeling? Or are we going to take another thing I'd love to do is innovating new models, like this new hovercraft is, we put a lot of, instead of just a new model, we innovate within the line. And so, I mean, it's a couple months for sure, but it's more and oftentimes years for, I mean, this butterfly, for example, this split board. I mean, we've been tinkering with that thing for years because we don't sit around and go, we need a new board because the customer demands a new board. It's more, hey, let's go and explore some of these concepts. And if we get them to a point where we think that it's bringing something new and innovative, then they come out. And so we go down a lot of dead end streets on that. And it's not until we, you know, really get something far along that we are like, man, people need to experience this, that we bring a new model out. And that generally takes many years.
Well, Jeremy, the boards that you're putting out are incredibly fun to ride. I think all snowboarders are really enjoying that. Do you guys see Jones ever doing skis? Is that something that has been asked of you guys over the years?
You know, I wouldn't rule it out. It would be one of those things where if we feel like we can bring something new to skiing, then absolutely we would go there. And you know, we've had our hands full with snowboards and recognize that there's so many really good skis out there. So, you know, that's a kind of a bold cliff to jump off. But, you know, that again, if we felt like the combination of how we manufacture and the shape and material layup was something new in skiing that we could bring, then that could happen in the future.
Yeah. And the reason I asked is I finally tried your Mercury binding, your snowboard binding. And I was floored. I was like, I for years, you guys had been asking me to try it. I was like, it's whatever. It's just a Jones binding. Like, I'm not going to, totally. Like, why would I do this? And then I'm like, holy shit, this is like my favorite. Like this rides the way I want, super surfy, you know, like that now flow. And I was just like, this is incredible. And again, to see you guys doing the outerwear, at first I was like, oh God, like I don't want to see Jones just throwing out outerwear. And then it was like actually the kind of stuff that I'd want to wear. And that's that's why I was like, okay, like these guys are obviously athlete and rider driven. So kind of whatever you guys get into at this point, it seems like obviously it's for a need. It's to make something better. It's not just like, hey, like let's try and get another SKU. Let's like, how do we get some more sales? I mean, this is, I mean, you, it was always, you know, when you left Rozzy and started Jones, it was like, holy cow, like this guy, I mean, he, it seemed like you had it so good. And then now it's like you, Jones Snowboards, is really one of the faces of the snowboard industry. So to see this transition over the last 10, 15 years, it's just been incredible. I look forward to chatting with you again, Jeremy. I mean, we always touch on a bunch of cool topics. Thanks for talking about, you know, the diet today and just your history in the mountains. If people are interested in your book, The Art of Shroplinism, where can they pick up a copy?
You can definitely, the local Jackson bookstore, you can get it online, mountaineers.org or wherever you get your books online. There's audio version of it. But by and large, I would say support your local bookstore. If they don't have it, tell them and they can get you it.
Awesome. Well, Jeremy, thanks again. I look forward to having you out in Jackson. I missed you this year. I was waiting for you guys at an event, and I think you went and did a late Four Pines lap and were a little late getting back, so I didn't get to catch up with you. But I'm glad we got to do this, and I wish you the best on everything, and just really excited. For anybody out there, if you haven't ridden a Jones board, you're blowing it. Make sure you try one. I think you're really going to enjoy it, because again, you can tell when you ride it that like, snowboarders are building these for snowboarders. And in turn, that seems to really work. So thanks again, Jeremy. Really appreciate it.
Always a pleasure. Appreciate the opportunity and look forward to seeing you in the mountains.
Right on. Thanks again, Jeremy. All right.
All right. Talk to you later.
Thanks again to Jeremy Jones for coming on the podcast. That was just a blast to talk to Jeremy. Can't wait to do it again. And once again, this week's podcast is being sponsored by the Alec Punks headphones. These are wireless audio communication for using on the mountain for skiing, snowboarding, mountain biking, basically anything that you want to do to communicate with people through wireless audio. Definitely check out Alec, A-L-C-K.io.